On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Integrated DNAPL Site Characterization. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Moscow, Idaho. I'm going to serve as the moderator. I'm going to cover a few introductory slides and then quickly turn the training over to our trainers from the ITRC team. Today's training is based on the online guidance, Integrated DNAPL Site Characterization and Tool Selection. We're going to introduce you to the guidance during today's training class, and we do hope that it becomes a resource that you can use after today's training. Today's class is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, CLUIN. A few housekeeping items to cover as we get started. Today's course is scheduled for 2.25 hours. We are recording the session. The trainers are going to control the slides today, but if you'd like to, you can download the presentation, and that's back on that CLUIN training page where you started today. Throughout today's training class, you're welcome to send in questions through the Q&A box in the lower right. We will take question and answer breaks, one in the middle and another at the end, and ask some of those questions out loud. In other cases, we'll get right back to you through that Q&A pod. At the end of the class, we do ask that you fill out the feedback form. We really do use your feedback. We're developing new courses. We're going to apply your feedback as we develop those courses. Also, we're going to help improve this training class as well. Through the feedback form is also your opportunity to get a certificate of participation. So if you want a certificate for attending today's class, be sure to fill out the feedback form. Check the box at the bottom to certify that you attended the class. Once you submit, the system is going to generate that certificate for you. Right now, the only way to get that certificate is by completing the feedback form. So if you forget to check the box, just go back. Check the box, submit again, and that's going to generate that certificate for you. More information about ITRC is available on the website, itrcweb.org. Overall, ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators. It includes our federal partners, Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. The full ITRC disclaimer is included in the notes section of this slide and on the ITRC website. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor U.S. government warranty material or endorse specific products. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws and experts. We encourage you to use ITRC's presentations and documents for educational purposes, both in your work and if you need to deliver training to others. We ask that you please credit ITRC, review the ITRC uses policy, and let us know about your successes. Use of ITRC materials for profit is not permitted. More information is available on the ITRC website. We have a wide variety of documents especially related to DNAPLs, and there's new documents coming online soon. I'll introduce our trainers for today's class. All trainers were members of the ITRC DNAPL Site Characterization Team. That team was led by Najia Gladys of Maine and Michael Smith of Vermont. Michael Smith has worked for the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation in Montpelier as a hydrogeologist and technical expert since 1986. He manages the characterization and remediation of numerous hazardous sites, including chlorinated solvent sites, manufactured gas plants, industrial sites, and petroleum sites. Dr. Tamsin McBeth is a vice president at CDM Smith out of Helena, Montana. She specializes in the development, demonstration, and application of innovative, cost-effective technologies for contaminated groundwater. Trevor King is a remediation technical lead with AECOM DNAPL team in Pennsylvania. He has global experience in the planning, implementation, and management of environmental and DNAPL remediation projects, including the development of characterization and closure strategies for soil and groundwater remediation projects and implementing cost-effective remedial actions. Jeremy Musson is the principal of innovation and optimization for Pinyon Environmental in Lakewood, Colorado. He has experience in the design of site characterization and remediation plans, including innovative state-of-the-art methods. Dr. Heather Ratanis is a principal research scientist at Battelle in Madison, Wisconsin. She manages environmental registration projects and serves as her section's bioremediation technical specialist. Her interests reside in technology transfer to integrate state of the science with field applications. I'll now turn today's presentation over to Michael Smith at the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation. Michael?
Thanks, Julia. I guess we're all on this because we've dealt with DNAPLs, dental aqueous phase sites, liquids. Some of the problems we've had working over the last 20 years or 30 years on this is we're not achieving cleanup goals. We're spending a lot of time and money, but substantial risk remains. We all have this stuff, and it's common site challenges. And what we found is there's an incomplete understanding of bean apple sites. There's a complex matrix, man-made and natural, that the bean apples are found in. We have unrealistic remedial objectives. Often the selected remedy just hasn't been satisfactory. So this poll question for people, there should be a box that pops up. For what year, for sites that you work on, when did cleanup activities begin? We have a lot with 1980s, 1990s. Interesting to watch. A lot around the 1980s. That's just some of these, or 1990s now too. I have sites from both 80s and 90s where we just really have not been able to do it. Looks good. Thanks. Thanks, Julian. So move to the next slide. Computer work. Okay, the problem, the bean apple sites we've had is really we have outdated characterization concepts. We consider contaminant flow as similar to groundwater flow. We simplified our assumptions and equations based on the Darcy flow, which people like me who came out of the water supply business and our degrees or hydrogeology was focused on water supply, we thought we could, which works really well for to model the flow with Darcy flow and works really well for water supply, it's protected, but it doesn't lead to good characterization because it doesn't look at the site geologic heterogeneity. It averages things. And the contaminant distribution characterization behavior is really strongly based upon the actual heterogeneity in the geology. And that's why the approach limited success in site remediation activities. Because we tried to generalize, tried to engineer past geology, and weren't able to do that. So the solution, this ITRC team has been working together for over 10 years, many of us, closer to 15 or 20, addressing different aspects of DNAPL sites. In 2011, we put out an integrated DNAPL site strategy, which looks at the whole sort of picture of DNAPL sites to give you a comprehensive site management process to do better. You can use it at any point in the DNAPL life cycle. The key topics which are in there are conceptual site model, remedial objectives, remedial approach, monitoring approach, how to evaluate your remedy. I mean, that also has associated internet-based training that's worth going on. And along with this, we have another document that fits very well in this process. It's the Mass Flux document. And we have a bioremediation of DNAPL document. And all these really fit together into the integrated DNAPL site strategy. Conceptual site model is the key for all of these. As with the geology. So just remember that when you're working on this, is you start the conceptual site model and you keep refining it throughout the entire process. Okay, now adding to that solution is this document, the integrated DNAPL site characterization. And this will provide more accurate conceptual site models, improve predictability of plume behavior and risks. So we actually we expect what can happen, in fact, actually what is happening. More defensible knowledge of contaminant distribution because of the an integrated DNAPL characterization, you actually understand where the DNAPL is and where the dissolved phase contaminants are based on the geology and the methods that the contaminant got into the system. It also facilitates communication. When you come to people, stakeholders or problem holders, and you can really better explain accurately the system, that really helps your communication. Reduces uncertainty, which is important for our business. And it performs, gives much better performing remedies because we have a better idea of where to focus our energy, where are the source zones, where are the hot spots that we can actually make a difference with. Now, some of the solutions we've seen over the past 20 years is that we have to incorporate this into it. We get away from the sort of Darcy generalized averaging flow, and heterogeneity replaces homogeneity, and isotropy replaces isotropy when you're characterizing. You have to understand that geology controls stuff, where it's very heterogeneic. Diffusion replaces dispersion. Diffusion is actually a much more important mechanism in spreading contaminants because we found that we don't have these big, large plumes generally. We have thinner plumes controlled by geological formations. And so we don't get that dispersion that was predicted back in the 70s. We actually have diffusion where it's going in and out of finer and more coarse grain materials. And that's the back diffusion. It's also a significant source, and that it'll actually maintain the plume and also contribute to plume growth. We use non-Gaussian distribution. Nothing's normally distributed in geology. Transit replaces steady state conditions. We used to think that sites were in steady state, but they're really not. They may be in temporary steady state or appear to be, but things are really transient. It's a dynamic steady state maybe, but again, it is changing. It's not constant. nonlinear and non-ideal sorption replace linear and ideal sorption, because it doesn't go that simple way the calculations would have you think. But after this training, hopefully you'll be able to apply this document to help support the integrated site characterization approach. And this doesn't work just on DNAPL sites. This also will work on really any sort of site. We realize that DNAPL sites often don't have DNAPL anymore. They're mostly the vowel phase anymore, especially with like the higher solubility NAPLs such as trichloroethylene. So this really, this approach is for all sites. It also works for LNAPLs. You'll be able to understand the characteristics of site conditions that must be considered when developing an informative conceptual site model. Again, it goes back to the geology, which I as a geologist will be harping on throughout the entire training, and hopefully you'll see that. Defining an integrated DNAPL characterization strategy. Once you understand the geology and how DNAPL and associated liquids flow in the subsurface, you'll be able then to find an actual strategy which will help you characterize the site. And you'll understand what tools and resources are available. We have a tools table in the document which will help you understand which tools to improve identification, collection of data, and evaluation of appropriate site data. And you'll be able to navigate this tools table after the class. And if you gain nothing else in this site, I'm going to go back to this. Geology controls DNAPL mobility and also controls the vowel phase. But the soil heterogeneity leads to differences in subsurface pore spaces, you know that, and the structure and the capillary properties. You also know from this picture or from what you've seen that significant variations can occur over very small distances and intervals. Even when you have sand that looks very homogeneous, if you start putting dye tracers in it, you'll see it's not homogeneous. There's really no perfect glass bead laid down neatly geology. It all changes. And most importantly, NAPL migration is strongly influenced by the topography of the geologic layers. So now I'm going to turn this over to Tamsin.
Thanks, Mike. So we're going to step back and kind of look at our training overview. At a high level, as Mike said, really now I think we appreciate that the subsurface behavior of DNAPLs is really technically challenging, and that a lot of our historical conceptual site models were really not providing enough information to really make sound remedial decisions, which is why a lot of the technologies and the remedial programs that were implemented really weren't achieving the objectives. In parallel, there have been numerous site characterization technologies that have evolved. And so this document is really intended to both describe the tools and the resources so that you can improve identification, collection, and evaluation of what types of site characterization you need to do in order to develop a more accurate conceptual site model. And this guidance really describes how to do that. It also describes, in this training in particular, we're going to step back and really talk about the physical, the chemical, and the hydrologic subsurface parameters that are important to understand in your conceptual site model. And so this step or this portion of the training is going to be kind of going back and talking about basic properties of DNAPLs and their characteristics, and then we're going to step into what we call the life cycle of a DNAPL. And so we're going to go through, make sure we've got an updated understanding of these things, because it's important, because these are the things that we're ultimately trying to characterize to build that more accurate conceptual site model. So the first thing that we want, or point we want to make, is that DNAPLs aren't just chlorinated solvents. Of course, we all work on chlorinated solvent sites, but really DNAPLs describe a wide variety of chemicals that can include things like coal tars, which is shown in the picture here, motor oil, bunker oils, PCBs, heavy hydrocarbons. And, you know, we even have a picture of that's actually pure phase PCE in a soil core. You can see that's a drum that was spilled of unused PCE. So we're going to kind of talk about the gamut and step back. Chapter 2 of the guidance document really reviews all the different kinds of DNAPLs and their characteristics, as well as describes the characteristics that control their distribution, their fate, and their transport in the subsurface. Although all these issues are really addressed in peer-reviewed literature, we really summarized them in the document, again, because they are crucial to designing an adequate characterization program. So different types of DNAPLs, we've got, again, your chlorinated solvents, creosotes, coal tars, heavy hydrocarbons, PCBs. So we're going to go to a poll question to ask our audience, what types of DNAPLs do you have at your sites? What issues are you dealing with? So here we have lots of chlorinated solvents. That's not surprising. Definitely one of the most widespread groundwater contaminants in the U.S. But we also have quite a few folks dealing with coal tars, some creosotes, some heavy hydrocarbons. That's pretty high. PCBs, we have a lot of folks working on PCB sites. Pesticides, mercury, wow, that's actually a pretty significant 9% of people working on mercury sites. That's unusual. And then some others even. So this really probably represents a typical distribution of the types of DNAPL chemicals that we're all dealing with. So we're going to go through some basics and describe important DNAPL properties. And it's important to understand the physical properties of DNAPLs because it really affects how mobile your particular DNAPL chemical is in a subsurface environment. So we'll go through some basics on density, solubility, viscosity, volatility, and composition. So first we're going to talk about DNAPL density, and this is really what makes a DNAPL a DNAPL. It's a dense non-aqueous phase liquid, and so density describes essentially mass per unit volume. It's also expressed as specific gravity, and so by definition, all DNAPLs have a specific gravity of greater than 1, which means they're heavier than water. We can have some really heavy DNAPLs where the specific gravity is much greater than water. And then sometimes you can have DNAPLs that have specific gravity much closer to that of water. And this really is what drives the vertical distribution of DNAPL. And it really results in gravity playing a major role in how DNAPLs migrate in subsurface environments. So in this case, DNAPL migration is dictated by gravity, not by components like advection in groundwater. The next chemical characteristic is the solubility or aqueous solubility of DNAPLs, and this is the amount of that compound that can dissolve in water. So here we have a table where we've got density and solubility of different types of DNAPL chemicals. So we've got our typical TCE, 1.46 density, so it's heavy solubility, about 1,100 milligrams per liter. And this is important because solubility dictates how much of each of these chemicals is going to dissolve from the NAPL phase into groundwater. So it really drives the loading or the dissolution of those NAPLs. And that's really important when we're talking about strength of sources and how much mass is migrating or discharging from sources. So something like TCE has a relatively high solubility. And then we can go the other gamut, which is something like pentachlorophenol, which has a very low solubility. Typical wood treatment sites, coal tars and different petroleum hydrocarbons all have very low solubilities. So just the amount of mass that dissolves out of those NAPLs is very different than what might happen, say, at a chlorinated solvent site. And then there's occasionally things like acid tars that are essentially completely miscible in water. So again, this really influences how much mass is dissolving or loading from that NAPL phase into the plume. The next property of DNAPLs that's important is viscosity. And this really represents the thickness or the resistance to shear flow of a fluid. For example, honey is more viscous than water, which is more viscous than air. So the DNAPL viscosity affects the rate that the DNAPLs can migrate through a subsurface environment, but it doesn't necessarily influence whether or not the DNAPL can migrate. So DNAPL viscosity primarily comes into play if there's mobile or recoverable volumes of DNAPL, as highly viscous DNAPLs are typically harder to pump in the oil and gas industry, for instance. This is a significant parameter. And so as you can see in this figure, we have an example where this viscosity property is temperature dependent. So here we have viscosity, and we have temperature, and we have different types of coal tars. And you can see here that as you increase the temperature, you reduce the viscosity. And so what happens is that actually makes those DNAPLs more mobile. So it's a remedial strategy. You can often warm things up to try to enhance the extraction efficiency of those NAPLs. So it does impact mobility in the subsurface. The next property is the DNAPL volatility. And this really represents the tendency of the DNAPL chemical constituents to evaporate into the vapor phase. The volatility of DNAPLs is measured by vapor pressure, and it directly affects the way those DNAPLs partition or transfer into the vapor phase, either directly from the DNAPL itself or from groundwater, from the dissolved DNAPL constituents in groundwater. And that's essentially what's being shown in this particular figure, where you've got some of those chemicals dissolved in groundwater, and then those chemicals volatilize into the vapor phase, say, at the water table. So vapor pressure is the maximum amount of a pure compound that can exist in the gas phase. And then in this case, Henry's law constant, which is the amount of dissolved organic contaminant that can exist in the gas phase. And so this property affects how DNAPLs and how groundwater plumes essentially impact or affect soil gas. And it's really important to consider when you're thinking about things like vapor intrusion and the VI risk for a particular site. The next chemical property to think about is really the composition of DNAPLs. And this is important because most of the time we're not dealing with NAPLs that are one pure chemical. Usually it's not pure TCE. It might be mixtures of TCE with other chlorinated ethenes or ethanes or petroleum hydrocarbons. Chlorinated solvents were often co-released with things like greases, oils, or stabilizers. 1,4-dioxane, right, is a great example with the chlorinated ethanes. So these mixed sources and these mixed NAPLs really behave differently than pure phase chemicals. And so one of the things that our team advocates is to really understand the specific mix of chemicals of the NAPL at your site and the particular properties, because really the composition affects all of these things. It affects solubility, it affects volatility, it affects viscosity, and so you really need to understand your NAPL. So now that we've gone through some basics to kind of talk about the properties of different kinds of DNAPLs and DNAPLs themselves, now we're going to sort of take it one step further and talk about the properties that control the way that DNAPLs migrate in a subsurface environment. And these are things that are influenced both by the NAPL itself and by the media or the soil or the rock that that NAPL is migrating through. So we've got interfacial tension, wettability, capillary pressure, saturation, and residual saturation. And all of these properties influence the mobility and the migration of DNAPLs. So first, we're going to talk about interfacial tension and wettability. Wettability represents whether a fluid is wicked into or repelled out of a subsurface media. And it's defined by the contact angle of the DNAPL fluid against the matrix materials in the presence of water. So For instance, the Dean Apple in a saturated zone with groundwater, this wettability is influenced by the types of soil that Dean Apple is in. So it's this really combined property of both the Dean Apple and the subsurface soils or sediments or rock, and can be affected by chemistry and the presence of co-contaminants. So these adhesive forces between the liquid and the solid cause the liquid drop to spread across the surface, as you can see in the figure there. And those cohesive forces with the liquid cause it either to ball up or to avoid contact with the surface. So the figure shows the wetting of different fluids. The first figure shows a fluid with very little wetting, while the second shows a fluid with more wetting. And that contact angle, theta, that's shown, is seen on the figure, is the angle at which the liquid-vapor interface meets the solid-liquid interface. And so this really describes these adhesive and cohesive forces and the tendency of that drop to spread out, either go flat or over the solid surface or to ball up. So the next important property is interfacial tension, and this represents the force parallel to the interface of one fluid with another, usually air or water. And this leads to the formation of the meniscus and the development of capillary forces and pressures between different fluids. So these fluids, this interfacial tension, viscosity, fluid density, the characteristics of the media, all of this affect Dean Apple migration and how Dean Apples migrate. The resistance to Dean Apple movement is expressed as a pressure difference between Dean Apple and the water phases, and this is called capillary pressure. And capillary pressures really represent the pressure difference between two fluids, such as groundwater and Napple. And due to interfacial tension and the formation of a meniscus, the non-wetting fluid, which is usually the Napple, develops a greater pressure than the wetting fluid, which is generally groundwater. So the capillary pressure is a nonlinear function of saturation or Napple saturation, which we'll talk about shortly, with the capillary pressure increasing at greater saturation. So the more Napple you have, the increase that Napple saturation, you increase that capillary pressure of the Napple itself. And this is really this capillary pressure must be overcome in order for that Napple to displace water from the soil matrix. And so this is really key and is one of the driving factors for if Napples will migrate vertically, because this capillary pressure is the pressure they have to overcome. So the Napple builds up on top of that interface. If it overcomes the capillary pressure, it migrates vertically. This is also one of the driving characteristics as you see changes in your lithology, say going from a sand to a silt, the capillary pressure is a function of that. And so the capillary pressures that must be overcome are greater for that lower permeability or conductivity silt or clay, which is why Napples tend to accumulate along interfaces where you go from high permeability to low permeability media. And this is really exemplified in this example. This is from a Bernie Cooper publication in 2003, where they were looking at these interfaces, if you will, you can see, and how Dean Apples would pool in different or on top of different types of media. So they looked at really fine grain material like silts and fine sands, medium sands and coarse sands, and then they also evaluated different types of Napples like creosotes and coal tars and chlorinated solvents, and they found that the pool height that would form was a function of both the properties of the Napple and the media, where you have the more viscous material like creosotes and coal tars sitting on really fine material like silts could develop pool heights, Napple pool heights of say 5 meters or 15 feet, but that as you increased the permeability of the material, those pool heights decreased, again, because that capillary pressures are reduced, and then that material, that Napple, can migrate more easily vertically through those more permeable soils and sediments. So the other kind of key factor to that really is this DNAPL saturation. And this represents the proportion of the subsurface pore space that's occupied by the fluid, either the DNAPL or air or water. And it ranges from 0 to 1. When multiple fluids are present, the sum of all those fluid saturations equals 1. And so the DNAPL saturation typically is something less than 1 in almost all cases in a subsurface groundwater environment, because the DNAPL typically shares that pore space with water or air. And the more porous media are generally water wetting. And so this is important because it really dictates how and when DNAPL is going to migrate. And this is also really affected by heterogeneity. So again, actually in finer grain materials, the DNAPL saturations actually tend to be higher, especially the residual saturation, and I'll talk about that in a minute, compared to more coarse materials. So this residual saturation is important because it is the saturation level or the pore space that's occupied by the DNAPL when that DNAPL is no longer mobile. So move to the next slide here. So this slide exemplifies that. And so what happens is that when you have your total saturation, which is the sum of the total porosity that that DNAPL is occupying, when that total saturation is less than the residual saturation, that DNAPL will not be mobile. And it'll be residual, as is shown in this first figure, where you just have these sort of globs of DNAPL, of residual DNAPL, that are hung up, essentially, within that pore space, but they cannot move. When the total saturation of DNAPL is greater than that residual saturation, that's when the DNAPL can potentially be mobile. Now, it can potentially be mobile but not moving, because you have to have both potentially mobile or high saturation, but then you also have to have a driving force that's driving the DNAPL, you know, out of these pore spaces. So a continuous DNAPL phase must be connected and must be able to sort of transmit the pressure in order for that DNAPL to actually migrate. And so this is one of, the most important characteristics when we're looking at both vertical migration of DNAPL and overcoming capillary pressures, and also lateral spreading of DNAPLs. So next is the permeability, and in particular the relative permeability. And this describes the potential to transmit a fluid, and it's both a function of the fluid properties and the media. So in groundwater systems, permeability is affected by the presence of DNAPL and by water. And so in this case, if you're looking at permeability, most of the time when we're going out and doing slug tests or hydraulic profile tool, we're doing is measuring the amount of pressure that it takes to displace or to move water. When we look at relative permeability, this essentially ranges from 0 to 1, and again is a nonlinear function of the DNAPL saturation. And so what happens is if DNAPLs are occupying that pore space, the amount of pressure, which is what's used to determine the relationship between pressure and flow and permeability of the material, is generally less than 1. So if you go out and you do a slug test or you do HPT in a DNAPL impacted site where you've got significant volumes of DNAPL, you're going to measure a lower effective permeability in that zone than if that pore space was occupied by water. So the presence of DNAPL really does reduce the effective hydraulic conductivity of the media, or what you're seeing in terms of the potential to transmit fluids. So now we're going to talk about what we call the life cycle of a DNAPL site. And this is really a characteristic of understanding, you know, these physical properties of the DNAPL, marrying it with an understanding of their interaction with the subsurface environment, but also understanding that most of the DNAPL sites that we're dealing with are very old and they're aged. And the way those DNAPLs get distributed in the environment changes over time when you're looking at an early release or a fresh release compared to a site that's 30 or 40 or 50 years old. And so we've built or incorporated this conceptual site model to really understand the life cycle of a NAFL because it can impact how you're thinking about your site and the decisions that you're trying to make. So we're going to use this basic. This is from Bernie Cooper's 2013 paper, just looking at a basic classic model of DNAPL migration, where you have, DNAPL. Here you've got an active source, so this is very early time. That DNAPL is migrating vertically through the vadose zone. It's hitting the saturated zone, migrating vertically again, maybe coming into contact with some permeability interfaces or different media and spreading laterally, dissolving out and creating groundwater plumes. So we're going to just talk about this when we talk about the life cycle of DNAPLs. The other concepts that we're going to bring in is really revising what we consider to be source zones. You know, for a long time within the industry, we really focused on finding sources of contamination and finding the DNAPL. And we often spent lots of time and money hunting for the DNAPL, and we very rarely would find actual DNAPL. So what we looked at when we were defining what sources are is really understanding that DNAPL is no longer considered the only source of groundwater contamination, and that we have to account for these other sinks, if you will, of mass that include sorption and desorption from the aquifer matrix and matrix diffusion, which Mike talked about. And we're really finding that it's these mechanisms that can control the longevity of the dissolved phase plume at DNAPL or former DNAPL sites. So often we're assuming that there's still NAPL left when there's not. There's just still a lot of mass in the soil and diffused into low conductivity zones. So first, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, we were really focused on DNAPLs and characterizing those DNAPLs. Then we started to understand that there's these secondary sources, the sorption source, and this diffusion source. So our thinking is evolving. Now, sorption is described in Chapter 2 of the document, and it really describes the proportion of the contaminant mass that will adsorb onto the aquifer matrix. And it really is an equilibrium process. You have a concentration of that chemical in groundwater and water, and you have a concentration of that chemical that will sorb. And so how much of that chemical will sorb is a function of the properties of the soil itself, and in particular for most organics, the organic carbon content of the soil, where the higher the organic carbon content, the more sorption that you're going to experience at your site. So in addition to the kind of loss, if you will, of mass, of chemical mass from groundwater as it sorbs onto the system, what also happens is that that contaminant mass can desorb from the matrix. So as things start to clean up, that equilibrium, if you will, between the groundwater and the soil shifts, and you might actually start getting more mass instead of sorbing, actually now desorbing to where that soil matrix is providing a source of chemical into groundwater. So it's important to understand because it affects both the retardation of the plumes as we're looking at whether our plumes are advancing or expanding. It affects the longevity of the plumes, and it affects our predictions about how long it will take for that dissolved concentrations, and in particular the low concentrations, to achieve stringent groundwater goals to occur. So the other important element is really this concept of diffusion. We've got this early time where you have this DNAPL, and this is kind of an early release. So you have residual and pooled DNAPL. That DNAPL is forming a high concentration groundwater plume. And what's happening is because you have this chemical concentration gradient, you have molecular diffusion of chemicals migrating from high concentration to low concentration. So in this case, we have a permeable sand. That's where the majority of our plume is. But we also have diffusion of chemical into this clay because of this process. And so what happens is that late time, had lots of pore volumes, flush the system, your NAPL is gone, but you still have all this mass that's loaded up in the clay and it's back diffusing out. And so really in this case, the source is not residual NAPL, it's this diffusion source. So as we've described, really looking at geology, it really controls where mass is, and it controls both the transport and it controls the storage. So you look at your transport is going to occur in your more permeable zones here, but your storage, because of diffusion, is actually going to occur in your low conductivity. So there's this interrelationship between your low conductivity and your high conductivity zones that you have to account for in your conceptual site models. And often, I mean, in this soil core, you can see if just visually, this is all sand, right? You'd log this all the same, but when we actually look at the hydraulic properties and the conductivities, they vary by four orders of magnitude in apparent homogeneous sand. So this is why this really starts to get challenging. And so in order to kind of bring all of this together, we have this 14-compartment model, which is this framework that was proposed by Tom Sell and Chuck Newell, and this really provides a methodology to help visualize the distribution and the movement of contaminant between these different chemical phases at your DNAPL site. So it can really help describe kind of the relative location of where the contaminant mass is and where the fluxes are occurring. So in general, it's describing your source or your source term where you've got low permeability zones and transmissive zones. And then it has your plume zone where, again, you have transmissive and low permeability zones. And then you have all your phases, your vapor, your DNAPL, your aqueous, and your sorbed. So these arrows are really describing the fluxes or the movement of chemicals between your different phases and between the different geologic, you know, low permeability and high permeability or transmissive zones in the source and in the plume. So this can really kind of help you compartmentalize all of these different phenomena and ensure as you're kind of checking the boxes to see whether your conceptual site model is complete, whether you're really accounting for where the mass is and where the mass flux is occurring. So we're going to use this and marry this 14-compartment model with our basic DNAPL model here. So this is what we call this early stage of the site, and this is where we have the active NAPL release. So we've got a lot of mass or high mass in the NAPL phase in your transmissive zone. So then what's happening is you've got volatilization occurring in your source, you've got dissolution of that NAPL in your source, and you've got sorption occurring in that source. And you also have advection in your high conductivity or transmissive zones as that plume front migrates in conductive zones down gradient of that source. So one thing to note is that in certain sites with certain types of DNAPLs, you can get what we call a prolonged early stage behavior. And so this is where you have a low solubility and high viscosity NAPL, NAPLs with high saturations, and they're basically immobile. So a lot of creosote and coal tar sites, for instance, really because of their low solubilities, never sort of migrate very far or dissolve out, and so they tend to be retained in very high NAPL saturations and really kind of never get out of that early stage. So next we have a mid-stage site. So this is where your active release is done, and now you have basically just residual NAPL here along your interfaces. And so when we look at that distribution within the source zone, that mass has sort of dispersed itself both in transmissive zones in the NAPL, the aqueous, and the sorbs, but also in low conductivity zones. Sufficient amount of time has occurred for those diffusion processes to occur and to load a lot of that mass into those low conductivity zones. And the same in the downgradient plume. Originally, the majority of the mass was in the aqueous phase, in the transmissive zones, but now because of diffusion and sorption, that mass has basically distributed itself through all these different matrices and media, so and storage vehicles, if you will. So the other important characteristic, like Mike said, is that really for a long time when we were conceptualizing and modeling our contaminant plumes, we were visualizing them as dispersive plumes. So in this first figure, we've got this model where we have this dispersion model. So you've got the advection, that plume is migrating down gradient. And what happened is you got this Gaussian distribution of mass as it disperses because of kind of the physical dispersion around soil particles and soil grains. And that dispersion is what was really driving the lateral or vertical spread of plumes. And what we're finding is that because of things like heterogeneity and anisotropy, really those, the flow paths from the source, you've got little dots of residual source material, the plume migrates more like stream tubes, if you will, through those highly conductive zones, and that really you don't see a lot of dispersion, but what does happen is diffusion. So you get those stream tubes, and then around the stream tubes, you get the halos of contamination as that mass migrates or diffuses into the low conductivity zones. So now we're going from the dispersive model to the diffusion model. We need to understand that to make sure we're making decisions. And this is another example just to highlight that heterogeneity replaces homogeneity. And really the majority of our models will often make simplifying assumptions such as homogeneous and isotropic, right? Well, the reality is that none of these systems, even as I showed in that example of that sand core, visually that looks about as homogeneous as you can get, but the reality is we almost never have that in these systems, and we have to characterize these sites and understand that these sites do not behave ideally and that you have to account for heterogeneity, you have to account for variability for sorption and for diffusion, and make sure you're accounting for that in your conceptual site model. So you can't just stick those borehole logs in the back of that report and forget about them. You've got to bring that heterogeneity, bring those stratigraphies back up into the front of that report and really integrate that understanding into how your chemicals are distributed in your environment. And just to highlight that point, we have now kind of the last stage, or what we call the late stage. So in this case, we don't have any residual NAPL anymore. And when we look at the mass distribution in the original source, we actually have low concentration in the transmissive zones. But because of sorption and back diffusion, the majority of the mass is actually still present in the low conductivity zones and sorbs. So this is really where you have this back diffusion and sorption controlled sources, and that's what's dictating the long-term pervasiveness of that contaminant plume. So now we're going to do a poll question based on what I've just presented and the sites that you're working on. Which of these life cycle phases is your site? Is it this early stage where we got active, mobile, NAPL, high saturation NAPL sources, middle stage where maybe some residual NAPLs, but a lot of sorbed and diffused mass, or late stage where it may be primarily diffusion and sorption controlled? So yeah, you can see in the responses, we have a few sites, you know, we definitely still have sites out there that are early stage where we have, you know, highly mobile, significant amounts of DNAPL, about half working in a middle stage, and then significant portion of people, 65% working at late stage sites. And this is really pervasive, one in the fact a lot of us are working on these sites where the chemical releases occurred 20, 30, 40 years ago. And so they really are a lot of these sites in this middle and late stage. And so with that, I think we will take our first question and answer period.
Thank you, Tanzin. For everyone in the audience, you're welcome to send in questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right. If you're on the phone line, you can unmute, #6 to unmute, and ask a question out loud. We have a question that's come in. Can you briefly elaborate on the applicability of advection dispersion versus diffusion models?
Yeah, I can talk on that a little bit. The advection dispersion is theoretically will work, and it does work to a certain extent, but if you were homogeneous, it would be exactly like the the models they show. But with the flow paths being much more constrained, much more based on the on small areas in the geology, you can have 10% of your aquifer has 90% of your flow. So that's where the you get advection dispersion within those flow paths. But where the diffusion occurs is on the sides of those. That's where that becomes very important. And that will actually expand the plume through the finer grain materials where it would not, where the water generally would not be flowing as quickly or be in direct communication. So they're okay, but I would definitely go for diffusion is more important. Understanding geology and you can understand where each of these will be occurring.
Yeah, and I would just add to that we've looked at this quite a lot in our modeling, and what you will almost always find is if you model your plume with a standard, you know, either analytical model incorporating, you know, dispersion, that it almost always overestimates the lateral spread of your plume. And so that's really just being aware that that is a bias of that approach when you're looking at kind of predicting plume transport. And so we're finding using models that constrain the dispersion term are typically more accurate, and then even better if you can really account for diffusion, because the diffusional spread, if you will, of chemicals is a much slower process than dispersion or traditional dispersion.
And that all leads to why you have to have enough resolution in your characterization to understand the subsurface. I mean, some people call it high resolution, that scares people away. I think we sort of prefer to call it adequate resolution. You have to get enough geologic and chemical and soil data to really understand where the flow paths are, where your contaminants are going to be. If you spend the money up front, we actually in our documents show how much money it saves in the long run. We can remedy it, it works, and you know what you're doing.
Do you have any experience in PCE, TCE, in altering the clay structures, making the clays more permeable?
I've read about this, but I've never seen it. Generally, I've just never seen it. You know, most of my sites, we don't find enough DNAPL product on the clays for there to be the time to change them. But apparently it does happen. I just don't work on big enough sites. Anybody else?
Yeah, I'm kind of the same thing. I mean, early on, there was a lot of high saturation PCE sites. They were finding that you could basically almost desiccate the clays. But in practice, and we have a number of clay sites where there have been long-term exposures to PCE, we really haven't seen, you know, those kinds of impacts, at least that we can quantify significantly in the field.
How does DNAPL work in rock formations?
Rock is another complicating factor. And in fact, just a plug, we are getting ready to publish a site characterization in fractured rock. That's such an important and such a complicated subject that we're actually dedicating an entirely new characterization guidance document on that one topic. The big difference really when you're looking at rock versus porous media is, one, you have to understand rock properties, how DNAPLs migrate in porous rock versus consolidated rock is very different. And then the other thing is that heterogeneity, and in particular the secondary porosity and fracture flows, and understanding like things like dip angles and actually drive groundwater transport or advection much more than the apparent gradients. And that can really complicate the conceptual site model, because you can't always predict or follow your potentiometric heads or your gradients and predict where that plume has migrated in fractured rock. So you have sort of two phenomenon. In porous rock, you also have, we talk about this diffusion, back diffusion in porous rock is a very significant process. So if you have things like shales or sandstones or even some limestones, you will have a lot of diffusion issues where a lot of that mass actually ends up in that primary porosity pretty quickly.
Another thing we stress in the document is that to characterize adequately a fractured rock site, you really need a team. I'm working on a big site right now where we have over 300 wells contaminated with PFAS, and it's all in the bedrock. So we've had our state geologist, who's a structural geologist, mapping for last year. We've had hydrogeologists. We've had surface water people. We really need to take a team to come up with an adequate conceptual site model. It is not easy, generally.
Thank you. We are out of time for this question and answer breaks. Before we move forward, I do want to mention those related links. It's a two-step process to get those to work. First, you select the name of the link, and then you look down and select that Browse To button. So if you leave before we wrap up today, please go to the feedback form. We really do use your feedback. As Tamsin mentioned, we're working on a new course, so your feedback can be directly applied as not only we're improving this course, but also developing a new course. Also, we're going to talk in the second half of the training through our flowcharts. So if you want a bigger version of just the flowcharts, those are available second to the last link. And then later on, we're going to talk about that tool selection Excel file. And it's right there, is that last related link. You may need to scroll down to see that one. And again, select the name of the link, look down a bit, select that Browse To. Those are going to allow those links to open in a new window for you. For now, we'll continue on with the second half of the training class. And I'm going to turn the presentation over to Trevor King at AECOM. Trevor?
A very good afternoon, Juliana, and good afternoon, everyone, or good morning, depending on where you are. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Juliana? Okay, great. So now that we've heard about DINAPA characteristics and the life cycle of a DINAPA site by Thompson, we want to take some time and discuss a process that we are calling integrated site characterization for DINAPA sites. That's the focus of a lot of this presentation this afternoon. And we can say it's basically a process that integrates the planning, the collection, and evaluation of characterization data. You know, when we were preparing this, one major highlight that we landed on was this process, there's a process and a module on new and existing data collection tools and techniques for DINAPA sites that we wanted to share with you. And that allows us to include both the physical, the chemical, and the hydrogeologic parameters that these tools can measure. And in essence, the site characterization process is actually described in detail in chapters 4 through 6 of our guidance document. And the purpose is really to help users, you know, prepare more accurate conceptual site models. And that basically translates to more effective DINAPA site strategies, which was the focus of the 2011 guidance document that Juliana mentioned. So with that, we're going to jump right into it. So we're going to talk about the planning phase. And as we speak about the planning phase, I want to ask the question, what is integrated site characterization? And in essence, for this guidance document, it really consists of 3 modules. And if I can get my pointer here, there are 3 modules. The first module is a planning module, there's a tool selection module, and then there's an evaluation module. And each module, in total, there are 8 steps that we can use to kind of refine our conceptual site model over the project life cycle with information obtained during each of those steps. So some of the focus areas we will look at this afternoon, you know, it includes data resolution. We want to be able to match the scale of the heterogeneity to the subsurface. We are looking at some of the objectives that are set out in the planning phase. We want to make sure that they are clear and they are very actionable. In other words, there's no confusion by anyone on what needs to be done and when it needs to be done. And if we can do that successfully, we are now in a position to select the tools that are best suited to achieve the objective of characterizing our sites. So, you know, it's all well and nice to talk about characterization, but but we need to, you know, get a handle of what are the benefits. What are some of the benefits of this process we are talking about this afternoon? So one benefit that we agreed on during the preparation of this document, and hopefully we can share and convince you, is the ability to reduce uncertainties so that you can improve your conceptual site model. This has been an area, a very contentious area, in that we realize that many of the conceptual site models are lacking, and a lot of work needs to be done in that area. So with this process we describe, and we believe it helps us to reduce the uncertainties in preparing our conceptual site models. If we can do so successfully, it will thereby enable us to prepare what we're saying are more efficient remedial actions or remedies. And this was the focus of the 2011 Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy document. And when we were preparing that document, in 2010, 2011, we realized that a lot was lacking in site characterization. And what we're talking about today is really, a development or, we basically identified that there needed to be some instruction in the area of site characterization. So that's another benefit, we believe, of this document. A third benefit is it can be used to avoid costly do-overs. And what we mean by that is if we can characterize our site properly and implement a remedial action as part of a remedial strategy, it lends itself to avoiding the uncertainty of where the source is, the extent of the plume, whether it's laterally or vertically, and by doing so, we don't have to move from one technology to another without any focus or direction. So this process is designed to really help us to avoid what we're considering costly do-overs, which, as we know, we're spending our money, and we want to make sure that we're efficient and as effective as possible. And last but not least, and there are several other benefits that are included in the guidance document, but a very important one, especially if you're a consultant, is to be able to communicate with all of the stakeholders that whatever you're doing, makes sense and advances the remedy, that you are considering or proposing. So as you speak to stakeholders, they can understand every step of the way what we are trying to achieve and how we're going to do it. And so it increases the confidence of everyone, especially when we are thinking of convincing not only our clients, but the regulators. So those are just a few benefits that we can point to. So moving forward, I am going to basically discuss this flowchart that was developed. And as mentioned earlier, it consists of the three modules that includes the eight steps. I'm going to talk about the planning module. And for the planning module, we are looking at the first four steps as shown in this flowchart. So what are those first four steps? It's about how are we going to define the problem at our site? Are there data gaps that may exist that we want to be able to fill? And to what degree or what resolution do we have to understand the problem? If we can do that successfully, we are then in a position to develop what we are calling a data collection objective. Basically, we're looking to figure out a way to what is it we want to achieve and how are we going to be doing that? And we need to put some framework around those objectives so that there's no confusion as the program unfolds about what is intended and how it's going to be achieved. And the last element of the planning phase is about designing a work plan. We want to put the elements of these first three steps into a written document that we can share not only with all stakeholders, but it gets taken into the field and gets implemented. And so there's always a check and balances if we can prepare a very focused and instructive work plan. So those are the elements of the planning phase, which is the first module. Then there is the next module, which is all about selecting the right tools. Because before we can get to selecting the right tools, We got to know what we want to look for and how are we going to do it, and then we can go about selecting the tools. And Jeremy, my colleague, is going to talk extensively about selecting tools and the array of tools that we have looked at and considered, and this has actually helped me personally in my career to be able to use it as a go-to for figuring out the best and the most appropriate tools for site characterization. Then the last module is about implementing the characterization program. And Heather is going to talk about that. It basically includes three steps about implementing, performing that characterization program. And basically, as you collect data, you're always looking to update your conceptual site model, because you've got to keep a check and balance on that model to make sure that it's current and it's relevant. So that's what we're going to talk about. But before we jump into the meat of my presentation, which is all about planning, we have a poll question for you. And that question really is, do you have a Dean Apple site that is being characterized for the first time? Three options: yes, first time, yes, insufficient, no. As we can see, as you fill in the responses, we can see most of it is insufficient. And the importance of this question, besides seeing what the audience has seen or have done, it really helps us as we present to focus the presentation to try to answer some of these questions during the presentation. So for the most part, most of us have sites where characterization, we believe, was insufficient. So let's move into the next phase of my presentation. But before I do so, there may be a few questions that are out there, and it came up in the past, and we just want to address it right now. And that is, many of us are familiar with the US EPA's data quality objectives that were established over a decade ago, I think it was 2006, where you have 7 steps, very useful. I'm sure all of us have used it. And so what is different from those data quality objectives to what these guys are talking about from ITRC? Well, as shown in this slide, we looked at this extensively, and what we landed on was to really integrate those 7 steps of the data quality objectives into the planning phase of our guidance document. So the 7 steps of the data quality objective are captured in the planning phase of the site characterization process. With one caveat, we decided, or we felt it was important for us as practitioners to move beyond just developing a plan. So we added to this by including the tool selection, as well as developing the implementation and performance aspects of the site characterization. That's why we have additional modules attached to this flowchart. So here we are. We are talking about the planning phase, and as I mentioned before, there are 8 steps. The first step is about defining our problem and assessing the uncertainties. That's the first thing that we need to do. And so to do that, we are looking at assessing existing data, or many of our sites may have a conceptual site model already established. So we want to revisit that. We don't want to start from scratch if we don't have to. And if we can do that successfully, with input from a number of professionals, as Mike mentioned, some of these need to be collaborative. You need to probably have your geologist, your hydrogeologist, maybe the engineer as part of this team, as you look holistically at your site and as you look holistically at your conceptual site model, to make sure all the pieces are there. If you can do that, and as you define your problem, you want to figure out, well, what really are we looking at? What is it we really have to answer? Whether it's from a stakeholder standpoint or from a regulator standpoint. So it's important for us to, I lost my screen for a moment, so my apologies. So we want to be able to, as I said, to be able to define the problem at hand and to develop a plan to solve that problem. So as we think of our problem, we look at the data, we are looking to identify any uncertainties with that data that we have and with our model. And if we can do that, then we are able to move on to the next step. But in order to illustrate this process, we thought it's important to illustrate it in terms of an example. So as I go through each step of the planning phase, and as my colleague does the same with their section, we are going to be moving back and forth with this example site. So let me set this up. This was a site which one of our team members worked on. It was about like half an acre. It was set in a commercial and residential location. As shown on the figure here, you had buildings, residential buildings to the north, some to the east. You had a gas station as well to the east. Let me get you. To the west, there was actually a fence here, but there were residences to the south. And then to the west, there were garages. What they did in 2004 when characterization was done, because this was a gas station and between, it operated for several years. But by 2004, they realized there was a discharge and some work needed to be done. So the consultant at that point in time, not my team member, they came in after the fact. They had installed, several groundwater and monitoring wells. And basically, we have a scatter of wells here, which, the diamond shows the wells, the monitoring wells, the circles show soil borings that were established. The color code really represents red exceeded above standards, green below standards. But in terms of what was done, they actually installed several wells. There were five wells, monitoring wells with 10-foot screens. And we're going to talk a little bit about screens later in the presentation and the value of monitoring wells for characterization. But they used monitoring wells for characterization. They installed 18 soil borings, 5 foot, and they collected samples every 5 feet. However, during that characterization program, they took no soil gas samples. So, that's a red flag in today's terms because soil gas is so prominent in our business that from vapor intrusion, that would have been, it would have been obvious today, but it was not necessarily obvious back then. By 2008, when they completed some characterization, and they delineated what they considered to be the source area as reflected here by the blue, and then the extent of the dissolved plume as represented by the the dashed line, that's what they considered to be the full characterization and delineation. And that was laterally as well as vertically. As you can see, for the most part, it was limited to on-site with groundwater flowing to the southwest, so there was some extension to the southwest, but it was based on some limited data. In 2008, they did some remediation. So they went into the source area. They did some in situ chemical oxidation for the dissolved plume. They implemented an in situ bioremediation approach to address. The compounds of concern here were were hydrocarbons. So how does this example site play into what we are talking about from a planning phase? So while the number of samples, whether it was soil or groundwater samples, seem extensive, in reality, based on what was observed, because by 2011, they went back to this site to verify whether the remedial action was effective. And lo and behold, they realized that the source area was still elevated. Nothing much had changed in the dissolved plume. And so there were big questions. That's when our colleague company got called in, and then they began to revisit this with the intent of a more focused or higher resolution program in mind. So as we think in terms of the problem for this site, there were a number of uncertainties. There was uncertainty in relation to the plume delineation. There was no downgrading control, particularly today. To the southeast. The source area was not properly characterized. So when they actually, and this I'm speaking ahead, but when they actually implemented the IFSCO program, it was severely lacking in terms of what was done and where it was applied. So it was no wonder that there were limited changes in the remedial action when they revisited it. By 2011, when they got back to the site and the monitoring program was very sporadic between 2008 and 2011, but when they did some evaluation, a re-evaluation in 2011, they realized that there were no specific guidelines for performance evaluation at this site. And so there was no wonder there was a problem with verifying how effective the remedial actions were, because there was no real baseline to check it against. So that was really identified as a problem as they were assessing the uncertainties. And the fourth one that's listed here, and there are several others that are actually mentioned in our guidance document that I would encourage you to, as you review that document, you'll be enlightened about more about some of these uncertainties. But soil gas, as I mentioned, and VI, that was not even on the radar screen at that point in time. And by 2011, it became. So that was the first step about defining the problem. So with the problem defined, the next step in any characterization program is really the ability to identify, well, now we know there's a problem, we look at the CSM, what really are the data needs, and what type of resolution are we interested in to make this program more effective and for selecting not only the right tools and completing the characterization properly, but moving on from there to the remedial strategy. So in terms of the data needs and spatial resolution, what you really want to look at when you're designing a site characterization program, you want to think in terms of how do your uncertainties translate into data needs? What is it you're looking to find? There can be several factors that would influence this, whether it is the heterogeneity of the formation you're looking to understand, do you have good vertical resolution with respect to your site? Do you understand where groundwater flows? It's flowing, the distribution, looking at, in addition to that, what are the receptors, the potential receptors? These are all the things that you want to make sure that you consider as you you think of your data needs from your problem. And then you want to figure out, well, how much resolution do I really need? These guys are talking about high resolution, and the context of that simply implies, a very expensive and costly program. Mike mentioned a few minutes ago, whereas that may seem to be the case, and that was actually the thinking several years ago, we have realized that that is not necessarily true. Spending the money up front, some money up front wisely, using some of these techniques will help you to put your arms around the problem and figure out what needs to be done, and it translates into much more efficient and effective remedial strategy, because ultimately that's where we're all hoping to end up with, an effective remedial strategy that gives us a well-defined endpoint. So as you think of the data needs and the spatial resolution, you got to figure out how much is needed and make a determination of what is it that is controlling transport in the subsurface, with respect to whether it is lateral or vertical transport, or what actually is being held up in the soil matrix and may contribute to subsequent back diffusion, as Mike mentioned. So if we can understand and take care of step two, we are well on our way to figuring out, well, how we can move forward. So we wanted to kind of just show you how this applied to our example site. So they realized that, when it came to groundwater, we needed actually more groundwater samples to actually define the limits of the plume. So they were thinking, we got to go in there. We got to put in probably some more monitoring wells, or better yet, because it's site characterization, maybe we don't put in monitoring wells. Let's just do a program where we collect, let's say grab samples, qualitative screening of the data, and then that information can be used to direct where to place monitoring wells if we needed higher resolution. In addition to that, there was uncertainty, as mentioned, with respect to the source area. So that required the need for additional samples. And so a sampling program, a soil sampling program was identified. And combined with that was a soil gas sampling program, because we had no data on soil gas. We have residences today, you know, to the south, as shown here, and some across the street. So there needed to be some resolution. So in order to get that data, we had to go back into the field. And so that kind of crafted the thinking with respect to how are we going to identify the data needs and solve the second step of this process. So moving right along, you know, this slide really is intended to show some of the vertical characterization that was done back up to in around 2004 when the initial work was done. As we can see, there was, we can say a fair amount of vertical characterization and delineation, you know, to the east of the site, looking at this cross section from east to west, translated here, vertical profile. The blue actually represents what they delineated as during their initial characterization program. But as you move from east to west, you can see there is a pink area that suggests a lot of uncertainty. So when they implemented the source area treatment with the ESCO program, based on the grid program that was implemented, they missed a lot of the source area because they relied on the initial characterization that was done. So this was kind of revealing, not surprising, but revealing in the context of what additional work needed to be done. As you can see here, this characterization was also extended up to 10 feet. The actual depth to water, or the target zone, was anywhere between 10 and 25 feet. The water table fluctuated, but there was, between 10 and 25 feet needed some additional characterization, particularly when it came to the groundwater quality. So this, you know, this example, as we looked at the example site, really was designed to help us to figure out the data needs as it related to our example site and what was there, and then we will talk about what they did. So the next step of the planning phase, and we complete this step, is really about establishing the data collection objectives. So there are two points here. The first point here is about establishing specific, clear, and actionable objectives. So fancy words, what does this all mean? Basically, what we are advocating, and this is developed quite extensively in the Integrated Indianapolis Site Strategy document, in the terms of SMART objectives, is really that whatever we decide to do, it needs to be very specific. We need to say that we want to collect, let's say, X soil samples in a certain amount of time, or using specific techniques, or specific reporting requirements. You want to be very specific. So if you can be specific, then it's clear to everyone what is it we are looking to obtain and how we are going to obtain it. And then it needs to be actionable. We need to develop a plan that is practical, adaptive, and realistic. Because no use saying that you want to do something, you want to collect 100 samples, that's probably not realistic, Or if you have, samples impact very deep, you want to use, let's say, install X number of wells, every five feet or something of that nature. The point is, your objectives need to be very SMART, which is specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and time-bound. And I'll mention that in a later slide. And as we develop our objectives for the planning phase, we need to consider the data types and quality. How much data do we need, and what type of resolution are we looking to achieve with this program? So establishing data collection objectives. So if we were to turn that back to our example site, we may want to be able to develop what we are calling broad objectives. That's high-level objectives. And that could be, Mr. Client, I, as your consultant, we are going to delineate the extent of your dissolved plume, and we are going to determine the stability and the attenuation rate. Very high level, you know. So if I give that to someone without any details or specifics, it's going to be hard for you to figure out what is it they really want to do. So we got to begin to drill down. And by doing so, we will say, well, you know what, we're going to collect grab groundwater samples, and we want to do so, you know, at X feet and Y feet, whatever that number needs to be. We also going to collect some soil borings, and we can do so every, you know, X feet. We want to be able to capture the subsurface variability and the heterogeneity. We also want to be able to, at the end of the program, delineate to a certain standard. In this case, that's drinking water. It could be a soil standard. And after we collected some of our data, we may decide, you know what, I got a good idea, qualitative what may be there. I want to install a couple of wells. So we say, okay, we're going to install, based on the size of the site, what is known, we'll install, you know, let's say X number of wells. In this case, I say 3 to 5 wells, and we're going to monitor those wells. So we also want to talk at the beginning of the process, how often are we going to sample these wells. So we, and using your regulations and discussions with all the stakeholders, we may land on, let's say, quarterly or semi-annually for X number of years. As you get that data, how are you going to process it? Don't wait to collect the data and then process it, or collect data that you're not going to process. That's just a waste of time and money. We say we want to evaluate concentration versus time, or concentration versus distance trends. You know, everybody knows what you're looking to achieve once you collect the data. And you may want to specify, well, we want to figure out, do we analyze all the compounds under the sun? Probably not. If we know it's a gas station, we want to focus. If you know it's a solvent site, you may want to focus on specific compounds, or you may want to focus on certain controlling compounds after you understand what may exist in the subsurface. And of course, geochemistry is very important as you consider remedial action. So that's kind of what you may want to consider as part of your step three in terms of your objectives. And as we come to a close, I have another poll question here. And the question is, have you collected data that were not optimal for deciding what to do next? In other words, collecting useless data, or data that is not, no data is necessarily useless, but if you don't use it to make an informed decision, that's when, you know, we run into trouble, because data collection is probably the easiest part and the cheapest part of the whole process. It's the analysis that goes into that data, and the reporting and write up that data that's actually, you know, costs a lot of money. So here we can see most of us have collected data that were not optimal for this, for deciding. So hopefully, at the end of this presentation this afternoon, you would get some tips, and after your review of the guidance document, it will help us all to be better practitioners in the field of integrated site characterization. So as we begin to wrap up, as I think of our dry cleaner site, what the consultant actually landed on with respect to the objectives for revisiting this this dry cleaner site is that they decided, you know what, we got to define the plume exceeding certain standards. They were also going to assess remedy progress, both for soil and groundwater. So they actually discussed that beforehand and figured out how they were going to do that. They were also going to assess the shallow soil vapor and VI threat that existed or may exist at the site. And they were actually going to actually get this done in a very short time frame, days, as opposed to the linear approach. You collect the sample, you go back to the office, you analyze it, and then you go back and forth. They were going to do this in a number of days as opposed to stretching it out in a number of weeks. And that really played into the approach of using the triad approach that was actually implemented at this site. So once they understood the objectives, what data was needed to be collected? As an example, they decided, well, you know what, they're going to go in there, use the geoprobe, collect continuous cores, you know, map the lithology as well as the boundaries. They were going to fill the data gaps identified by collecting additional groundwater samples. In this case, they landed on 4 feet. You may decide on a different interval, but that's what they decided to do. And then for soil gas, they were going to collect samples from X number of locations every five and 10 feet. So that's what the consultant and their team decided to, how to address the uncertainties with revisiting this site. And as I mentioned, this is a real site. the last step of the planning phase, it's all about how do we put this into a document that is very actionable. So we've established, you know, the first three steps. We got to write that into a work plan. We got to be able to work. The work plan has to be very clear in terms of recognizing the data limitations that we collect, what data we need, and what are some of the limitations. We also have to figure out and selecting the correct management tool, because you're going to collect this data. How are you going to process it? You got to talk about that. You got to make a decision before moving into the field or to the next step. You're also going to figure out of how you're going to analyze the data. You know, develop a data analysis process. Get the right people involved. Get the necessary technical reviewers and experts to, you know, to weigh in on the interpretation and the decisions that would lead to the next step. Also, as a plug, is really to consider real-time analysis. You know, there is a, you're probably all familiar with the triad approach. In many applications, this is making more and more sense because it not only shrinks the time we spend in the field, but it also helps the, it also helps in the decision process with all the stakeholders and without changes to stakeholders. You may go through a process of screening data, qualitative, followed by quantitative measurements. You're filling your data gaps and you're mapping that extent by updating your conceptual site model. So those are basically the four steps. At this dry cleaner site, just, you know, kind of show you a couple of pictures here. They collected soil samples, typical of what most of us are accustomed to. They actually had a couple of geoprobes into the field. They were actually fortunate because they were actually three sites, similar sites, where they were able to use four geoprobes between the three sites and a fixed lab, as shown on the right here, with with a mass spec. And they were actually able to analyze anywhere between 80 soil samples and 60, 80 and 60 samples on a daily basis between the three sites. So they had estimated, I think, 15 days, and probably within just over a week, they were able to finish the characterization for all three sites. So that was a big saving, and a kudos to that consulting team. As we think back of what they actually did at the as part of this recharacterization, they went in there, and shown in the yellow triangles is basically the proposed boring locations that were kind of scoped before they went into the field to answer the question of the delineation limits and to confirm what remained after several years of remedial action. So they decided they were going to install 16 borings, that's the yellow triangles. At each of the borings, they were going to collect samples at every 5 feet for about 80 samples. They grabbed the groundwater samples at every boring again. Every boring between 15 and 25 feet, they were screening. They grabbed samples for about 48 samples. So that was able to, with that program, they felt comfortable in being able to answer what particularly existed to the south, because that's where a lot of residents lived, as well as to the southeast. Again, there were some access issues getting off-site to the south, so they had to work with what they had, but they had sufficient sampling points for soil and groundwater to answer the question in terms of where does the mass exist and what was the current status. So we spoke about soil and groundwater, but lo and behold, they were able to address the soil vapor. They actually installed 12 points and they collected two samples per point, as shown in this representation. Again, there was some quite a bit of sampling was done to the south, answering some questions to the east. There wasn't much information about residences to the north, so they ended up kind of going to the north to some extent. Based on the previous work, the western area seemed to be clean relatively based on the groundwater data and resampling that was done, so not a lot was done except to calibrate what was done specifically in this area. So that really brings us to the conclusion of the planning phase. So what have we talked about this afternoon? We've talked about the flow chart. I've mentioned that there are three modules: the planning, the tool selection, and the implementation. I spoke specifically about the planning module and discussed and tried to illustrate with an example site how do we define the problem and its uncertainties. We were able to identify some data gaps and the resolution in terms of principles, as well as transfer that to our example site. We, you know, with that understanding, we were able to develop some data collection objectives, which the key here, it's all about developing smart remedial objectives. Again, I would take a moment to refer you to the Integrated DNAPA Site Strategy 2011 guidance document that really goes into much detail about how this process works and how to develop smart objectives. Last but not least is putting all of this into a work plan that can be taken to the field. And before we take it to the field, we have to go to the tools. But the last thing I mentioned was about the DQO process, how it's integrated into the planning phase, and it focuses, and the planning phase basically focuses on the DNAPA sites and not just all programs as the DQO process speaks to. So with that, I would like to thank you for your time, and I'd like to turn it over to my colleague, Jeremy, who will speak about tools selection.
Thank you, Trevor. As we were developing the integrated site characterization document, we recognized that there were a lot of tools out there available to all of us, but they were generally poorly understood, and we have a tendency as professionals to stick with those things that we're comfortable with. So in order to get more options in our toolbox, we developed a framework that would allow practitioners more options. So as we go forward, I'm going to go through an orientation on how the tools matrix is set up and how we can go through selection process of the matrix. We'll revisit the case study that Trevor introduced and then a couple more examples just to run through the operation of the tools table, and then we'll just hit a brief summary. But before we go on, we'd like to do a quick poll and find out which tools you have all used out on your sites. I'll share, as we're looking for answers to come in, that the top three, the split spoons, the HPT and MIPs, they're all pretty well known, and I've used them in projects of mine, even the GCMS. But when we get beyond that into some of the more niche tools, they really weren't something that I even had any idea about. Those bottom three, which we can see here, participants in this training also the same way, not really used that heavily. So we want to get that out there. We want to be able to get better results that provide data that we can incorporate into our characterization plan. So moving forward, we've created a tool matrix that is downloadable. There's a link right here in this slide. And also, I believe it's on the right-hand side of your screen that you can get to download the Excel file. If you haven't done that, I'd really encourage you to do that as soon as possible. We've segregated the tools into categories and subcategories that were selected by the subject matter experts that we had on our team. This is intended to be a living resource, recognizing that our profession is constantly developing new technologies and ways to use existing technology that we may not have thought about previously. So, looking at the tools matrix itself, it contains over 100 tools that are sorted by characterization objectives like geology, hydrogeology, and chemistry. Their effectiveness in specific media, unconsolidated and bedrock zones, and the unsaturated and saturated zones. And they're ranked further by the data quality that they can provide us, some ranking from quantitative, which is where we're going to get our regulatory data, to semi-quantitative and qualitative. Within the tools matrix, we've included the ability to get more information by clicking on any of the headers. It will link out to a description of that specific characterization or data objective or zone, and will really describe why this might be important or how it's going to relate to your conceptual site model. We've also included a similar functionality for our our tools that are included throughout here. By clicking on any of the tools, it kicks us out to a, or it links us to a reference section with a description of where we can get additional references, more specific information on that tool. The description, really a kind of light version of the description of that tool, its applicability and data quality applications, and then the limitations or difficulty in use of that specific tool. And within the matrix itself, we can easily see which data objective or characterization objective, rather, a tool may be suited to by the green shading. So if we're looking at the matrix as a whole, we can sort through on our own and find tools that are going to help us achieve our goal. However, using that and looking at a matrix of over 100 tools and trying to get through those and pick something is pretty daunting, rather confusing, and generally turns people away. So we've included an ability to filter down based on our characterization objectives. So after we get through our definition of objectives phase, we're going to use a systematic process to select the categories of our data quality or data objectives, the parameters of interest, the geologic media that we're going to be investigating, whether or not we're working in the saturated or unsaturated geology, and what data quality we need to achieve. Sometimes we just need field screening, and qualitative or semi-quantitative is going to be sufficient. But if we're going to look for plume boundaries or other things that are going to be compared to regulatory values, we need to make sure we're getting quantitative data. Then we can apply those filters and evaluate the tools that are returned for their effectiveness, availability to us, and cost. Ultimately, we need to keep in mind that this is just a tool to help us identify things that are applicable, but not necessarily the best choice for us. It is up to the professional and the project team to really identify the tools that we're going to use. So let's take a look at how the filters are set up. They're all drop-down menu driven, and we can select our categories, geology, hydrogeology, and chemistry. And under chemistry, we have some subcategories based on the media that we're in. And then the parameters of interest within that, which are limited based on the selection you make in the type box. So here, we're limited to only geologic parameters. And then the subsurface zone that we're looking at, either bedrock or unconsolidated, we can pull in data for both. The zone, unsaturated or saturated, again, we could select both. And our data quality objective. Once we've selected all of these, we can apply the filters by clicking our search button. And when we do that, we'll see at the top the listing of the parameters that we included in our search summarized. And then our output is limited to only those tools that meet those characterization objectives. So you can see here we've taken a list of 100 and we've reduced it significantly to something that's much more manageable for us. We can use the tool to perform some additional searches. If, say, we've got multiple characterization objectives, as we likely do, within that same table, we can run a new search, and it will create a new tab that includes the new characterization objective parameters. We can also stack on top of the original search by just changing our parameters or our search filters at the top and rerunning it as an additional search within that tab. So once we've run through our filtering, we can look at what our results are and incorporate the selected tools into our characterization plan. And as all site characterization is, it's a cyclical process. We're going to implement the plan as we've designed it, evaluate our data, and then update our conceptual site model. And we have to reassess, have we met all of our characterization objectives? Has the data resulted in the need for new characterization plans? So we can repeat the selection as process as necessary. So let's jump back to the case example that Trevor introduced earlier in the training and take a look at the selection framework in practice. So the characterization objective that we'll go on is to delineate the lateral and vertical extent of the dissolved phase plume and the stability and rate of attenuation of the contaminants. So our goals are to define the boundary exceeding groundwater standards, assess the remedy progress and using soil and groundwater samples, and assess shallow soil vapor impacts. That translates into the filters listed here. We're looking at chemical data in all zones, contaminant concentrations in unconsolidated geology in both the saturated and unsaturated zones. And since we're looking for regulatory comparison, we're going to look for quantitative data. So we enter those into our filter and we run the search. And you can see here the listing of our data characterization objectives. And this is the result. We have taken that list of more than 100 tools and we've distilled it down to 22. So looking at this as proof of concept, the desire to expedite the assessment, the project team had selected direct push borings with soil sampling on 4-foot intervals, active soil gas survey, and the use of a mobile field lab to help them get to the end of their investigation phase. Let's take a look now at just some hypothetical case examples. I'm using a characterization objective here to determine the porosity of fractured bedrock formation in a DNAPL source zone and to evaluate the potential storage capacity of the rock. So we're looking at geology and porosity, bedrock, subsurface, and in the saturated zone. And here, we're only going to look at the qualitative data again as well. Putting those into our filter and running the search, we are brought down to 10 tools that are applicable to meet our characterization objectives, which I can certainly say that would be a lot easier for me to make an evaluation on what we're going to be able to use than trying to run through all that is out there in the Nexus universe of investigation methods. So one final example, and we'll be done running through the tool. We're going to look at our characterization objective to evaluate potential matrix diffusion issues associated with variations in hydraulic conductivity. So now we're looking at hydrogeology, and specifically hydraulic conductivity in the unconsolidated saturated zone. And we'll look at all data quality objectives. Plugging those into our table, our search results in 21 tools, which maybe is a bit more than we want to deal with. Let's have a look and see if we can refine those down. So we're going to modify our search, and we'll change our data quality objective, and that's the only parameter that we'll change, and we'll get it to a qualitative rather than quantitative or semi-quantitative, which returns 7 tools, and likely as qualitative tools, they are going to be a more cost-effective means of getting field screening data, at least. So in summary on our table, we use the characterization objectives as our guide to select the tools. We don't go in blind, pick a tool, and then hope it's going to get us answers that may be useful for us. The matrix is interactive with over 100 tools and links to further information on those, and then we can even get farther out into the details with resources on how and where we may be able to obtain the tools or vendors associated with. The systematic process where we select our tools, implement the plan, and evaluate the results. We align the data that we get with our characterization objectives and update our conceptual site model, and repeat this as necessary until we've met all of our objectives and we can move forward to the characterization reporting and remedy selection. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Heather Rectanis.
Thank you, Jeremy. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, excellent. Thank you so much. So we're now on slide 98, as the presentation slide shows, and we're dealing with the last section before the summary, so we're in the final stretch here, everyone. And we're going to be talking about the implementation phase in the integrated site characterization. And that's all about getting things done or conducting, which is part of the third module as the guidance document talks about, and it's circled here on the right. Can see here with the red circle. First, step six is implementing the investigation, and then step seven is performing the data evaluation and interpreting. So that's all about evaluating the data that's collected and thinking about those objectives that were established in step four. Step three, and documented in step four. So in step eight, the final step, but definitely not the least step, is updating the conceptual site model. I'm sure you've heard that quite a bit so far in this training. So moving on to talking a little bit more on the implementation phase. So it's time really to get into the field and conduct the investigation. And there's been plenty of slides on what kind of tools can be used and what kind of tools were thought about and documented in the planning. And let's remember also in that planning step four, that it's recommending a flexible sampling plan, something similar to the triad approach, which can allow for adaptive and dynamic field work and help so that it can help collect data that are needed to answer the objectives that were established in step three. So often with the dynamic nature of the investigation, step seven, as we see here in the second bullet, can often go on concurrently with step six when you're implementing the investigation. So as data collected, they're often evaluated against the objectives. So an example in this would be if you're trying to determine the extent of a plume, and that's one of your objectives, then maybe the steps of collecting, analyzing the data, and then comparing those against project-specific concentrations can be done multiple times. So think of it when you're stepping out in the field until you figure out where there's no more contamination. So for step seven, it's the meat of pulling all that data together and interpreting it. Typically, at quite a few sites, you're not just using the data that was just recently collected or is currently being collected. You can think about also integrating all of the data that you have. So going all the way back to step one, where you're assessing the CSM and trying to understand the site. So collaborative data sets are often generated and help in the data interpretation phase. You're adding to those collaborative data sets that were developed hopefully in step one when you're taking a look at the CSM. And that's a huge part of the integrated site characterization plan that we talk about, is not to ignore any of the data that has been historically collected, but think about how one can best use it. And oftentimes it takes multiple lines of evidence to evaluate your objectives. So understanding contaminant transport and determining the impact of contaminant storage on a plume's life cycle, as well as assessing attenuation capacity, often require a variety of data to be able to be pulled together to make the argument or better understand what's going on in terms of transport, or is attenuation going on? Do we have sufficient lines of evidence to make that argument, or is there not sufficient lines of evidence for attenuation, and then what would that mean for the site? So taking a quick break and going back to the case example that both Trevor and Jeremy discussed, at the site, the data were evaluated with respect to those objectives that were determined in step three and documented in step four. And let's remember the first objective was to define the boundary exceeding groundwater standards. This boundary was investigated not only in terms of lateral extent, but also in regards to depth, vertical extent, as well as geology. And on this map here, we can see that we have some of the historic data, and we have also some monitoring wells and soil borings. So at this site where we go in and collect the additional data, we can see the additional depths that we're seeing between these 2-foot intervals. And we also see that mobile lab data as well as fixed lab data have been collected to be able to help establish the relationship between the mobile lab results as well as the fixed lab results. And taking a look at the differences in what we're seeing here with the lateral boundary, we can see the old ISO contour in black versus the new red ISO contour with the new data to be able to show that the plume is extending slightly further south than expected, and that it could undergoes a residence as well. And it's interesting too that we can note is that those source area concentrations are remaining elevated, which, as Trevor talked about, was one of the reasons why this high resolution site characterization evaluation was undertaken. So in regards to the soil vapor data that were also evaluated, so not only just soil and groundwater were evaluated, soil vapor data were collected. And it links to the third objective that was to evaluate the vapor intrusion threat. So over 35 samples were collected. We talked about all the various data that were collected, and some of the information has already been shown, but this helps to summarize. Again, we have various depths being collected. Various depths being collected. And what we're trying to do is we're going to try to pull all this data together in the next step to be able to talk about the shape of the soil vapor plume and then also talk about what do the vapor analyses indicate from an on-site versus an off-site screening level perspective, especially in regard to this residence down here. So now it's time for, I think, one of the last poll questions for everybody. Before we get into that final step eight, the question here is, when do you typically update your conceptual site model at sites where you work? Whenever new data is collected, when a remedy technology begins to fail or is failing, whenever the CSM is determined to be inaccurate, maybe every 5 years when a 5-year review is done, or never. Once you went through that first conceptual site model 10, 20 years ago, you've stuck with it. Okay, we've got some good answers varying. The primary one is when new data are collected and also when the CSM is determined to be inaccurate. Okay, so let's move on to the next slide because the next slide has to do with updating that CSM. And here are some recommendations that this ITRC team came up with and things to think about when updating the CSM. When data is collected from any phase, it can be used in the CSM. It's part of the whole concept of having a living CSM, that it's not done once, it's done. It's constantly being updated and it's constantly being refined as more information is learned about the site. As a project progresses, you know, data needs shift so that it also can influence how the CSM is being updated. In later phases, you know, additional data collection can often be driven by specific questions in terms of compliance. Maybe we're worried about impacts, secondary impacts to groundwater as a result of remedial technology. Something like that could be used as a basis for improving and updating the CSM. And last, of course, this integrated site characterization team and document talks about the continuing evolving nature of the CSM and that it is a living entity. So with those in mind, let's go back to that case example. And let's see how that CSM is being updated with all the new information that's been collected from this integrated site characterization investigation. So here's the figure of the site again. I'm sure we're all used to seeing it with all the new data, soil, groundwater, and soil vapor. And again, that we're going to compare the old contour to the data to help us delineate that new contour that we had already seen before. You can tell that the plume shifts. It goes a little, you know, further to the south. And then let's think about that. So that's just a plan view. But what about that depth and the, because we were talking about not just extent from an aerial standpoint, but also what's going on in terms of the vertical standpoint. And the new and improved understanding is this red portion down here. And with the additional data here, the source area was found to extend further west than expected. And that kind of helps explain why a lot of the concentrations in the source area had not decreased. So with that, let's consider what are the benefits of doing an integrated site characterization here at this particular dry cleaner site. So using this approach at the dry cleaner sites, they realized about 50K savings, which is fantastic. There were three sites that were done, so it's 150K savings across the three sites. So that's about 33% savings that they realized. In addition to the analytical contaminant data, the additional information and understanding the geologic CSM created, you know, during the soil borings in the source area, it really helped understand what was going on with the prior remedial action. Why the PCE concentrations in the source area didn't reduce as much as we hoped to on the surface. You know, they were still exceeding regulatory standards, but it is important to point out that the original concentrations were around 100 milligrams per liter, so that targeted source area treatment did help reduce it down to 1 to 5 milligrams per kilogram, but it still didn't get it down to the regulatory levels that were needed. So the optimized data density was also really helpful in understanding what was going on the site from a risk perspective. And it helped accurately determine where that source area is so that when they go back in, they can better target that area to get a better improvement the next time. You know, it's basically the next time around that they're doing this work. So with that kind of summarizes everything together for this case example, and it is time to turn the back to Michael Smith.
Thanks, Heather. I hope you've enjoyed this training. I think it's really useful, and I want to stress a couple things. Remember, this is not just for Dean apples. It covers all pretty much any type of site, as far as I'm concerned. But if you follow this process, it'll help you with your planning. The tool selection tool is great. And how to implement, including how to work with the data. That's a huge thing. You get a lot of data with this type of characterization. You have to understand how to use those data and manage them. So that's important. But we have found that if you follow along with this, I mean, we definitely have been getting much better results. I worked at this process on an enforcement site at a small dry cleaner when we went in and did the work because the owner was recalcitrant. And once they saw what we came out of there with actually a fairly low amount of money, they gave up immediately. So it really clarified exactly what we had to do, and it worked very well to get the owner to start working, doing what he needed to do without going to court. So we've had too many D-Apple sites in the past that are stalled and unresolved, and this will actually help this. It's important that you examine, what we try to do here is examine D-Apple mobility and heterogeneous environments so you understand when you're doing characterization you may not have any DNAPL left, and you probably won't on a site like TCE site, especially if it's a little bit older, but you have to understand the original mobility so you understand where the why the plume is shaped the way it is. And then one of the better things at the end, important things at the end, is you really get better trust, confidence in your site decisions. Your stakeholders are happier, they aren't as concerned, and you can spend less money, and so your problem holders are happier. So I'd like to lead into our second question and answer. I'll turn this over to Juliana.
Thanks, Michael. Everyone is welcome to send in questions using that Q&A pod in the lower right, and we'll get to as many of those questions as we can. I'll also remind you about our feedback form. We really do use your feedback and appreciate you taking just a few minutes now to give us your feedback on today's training class. If you're interested in a participation certificate, the feedback form is the way to get that. So complete the feedback form. Be sure to check the box at the bottom to certify you attended. Once you submit, the system is going to generate the certificate for you. And right now, that's the only way to get this certificate of participation for today's training. So if you forget to check the box, just go back, check the box, submit again. If you have more than one person at your location, once the first person submits, there's a link where you can follow and go back and get a certificate for everyone in the room. I also point out we have our links to additional resources. This is where you can get to the guidance document that's the basis of today's training. You can download the PowerPoint presentation that you've seen during today's training class, as well as some other additional valuable links. And that page is going to continue to be available for you. So we're going to get to as many questions as we can in the next 10 minutes. One question that came in for PCB or fecal sites, how do you determine a good way to screen soil for sampling? Are there other tools or guidance instead of PIDs or FIDs? Do you think that an XRF screening for arsenic or chromium may be helpful, or will those contaminants not travel as far as the PCP?
What's happening quickly is that we're getting a lot better field labs, field tools, which will take the place of the old-fashioned sort of screening, which is yes or no sort of results. So I would definitely look at those. We've had some good luck with the immunoassay, but that was 15 years ago. I'm sure there's much better. I haven't worked with creosote, but I'm sure it's similar to coal tar, so you could possibly use like a Targos. And you may end up spending a little bit of money, more money up front first, but it'll come back, and the savings will come back to help you. I can't really speak about the X-ray fluorescence on the metals.
Does the ITRC guide provide tools to report data and 3D mapping?
We don't provide those sort of tools. We have references where you can find them. You have to buy the software, and especially for 3D mapping. But so we do provide references, but not the actual tools.
And this is Juliana. In July, we're offering a couple of training classes, groundwater statistics for environmental project managers, and that's on July 18. And on July 25, geospatial analysis for optimization at environmental sites. Both of those classes talk more about software, and you're welcome either to sign up for the July classes, registration's open, or if you'd like to, archives are available of those classes. And you can find those on the Cluin training page or on the ITRC website. And if you have any trouble finding them, you're welcome to email us at training@itrcweb.org. For our participants on the phone line, if you'd like to, it's #6 to unmute so that you can ask questions out loud. While we're waiting for the next question to come in, for our trainers, can you tell us more about that new fractured rock team? What is that guidance document going to be able to do for us?
Sorry, just trying to get my phone working again. Basically, the document is for characterization and remediation of fractured rock. It does fit into the whole integrated site strategy process, but it focuses on fractured rock. It's going to be available, right, it was November 27th. Right now, it looks like early December. It's similar to this. It incorporates this tools table but expands it, has the same sort of integrated site strategy, and also provides some ways and some methods for looking at remediation of fractured rock. We expanded the 14 compartment model that Tamsin talked about to, I think it's 21 compartments, to try to get the different fluxes you'll see in fractured rock, and that can be helpful and useful in helping you understand where your distribution of contaminants will be. We talked about the conceptual site model in fractured rock, and the differences between and the similarities between fractured rock and consolidated materials. It will definitely be as worth looking at. Like I say, it's an extension of what we have here, and also going more into the characterization issue. It always is we sort of defaulted in the past to containment in many sites. So there actually are better methods, or methods that can be successful now, that we've really learned over the past 20, 30 years.
Does that document just apply to DNAPLs?
No, it's for all. It actually doesn't use the term DNAPL in the title. It does apply to DNAPL, but like this document, it applies to all types of sites. Even though this document is titled DNAPL Site Characterization, and we focus a lot on that, the actual characterization strategy applies to all sites.
Thank you. A reminder for our audience, we do use your feedback, and we'd really appreciate you giving us your feedback. As we've mentioned before, we are working on that new fractured rock guidance and online training at the same time. So the feedback that you're providing us is something that we're going to be thinking about as we're developing that new training course. We also have the ability to update this training course as well.
We're also hoping, as part of our implementation, is to do a four-hour course on the fractured rock document at some of the conferences. If we can get funding or an approval, maybe Patel next year, we don't know yet, but we are trying to work on that.
We don't have any more questions coming in, so we'll go ahead and wrap up a little bit early on today's training class. I'd like to thank our trainers and our participants for joining us. If you have a question that you weren't able to get in, you're welcome to send us at training@itrcweb.org.